This program was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, irirangi te motu, MPR.
Listening to live and on-demand shows has never been easier on MPR. All you have to do is go to the App Store or Play Store on your device and search up Access Internet Radio NZ. Select and download the first option at the top of the list. Once you've downloaded the app, the next step is to open the app and look for MPR. Once found, select it and then browse freely. Supported by New Zealand On Air.
Welcome to Manawatu Conversations, recollections of the past and sometimes opinions about the future. Today we have with us...
Felix Quinn.
Roger Mann.
And I'm Stuart Burks. Okay, now, Dennis, you came here as an architect in
79. From Wellington, where I had been working for 3 years after coming back from England, where I'd been for 2 years, and prior to that, Rhodesia, which is now Zimbabwe, for 2 years. And prior to that, 3 years in Wellington, which takes me back to where I started.
Okay. So you grew up in...
In Whanganui. Went to secondary school there, and then from Whanganui I went to Victoria University. Wellington. You did it at Wellington. To do my architecture intermediate. And after that, I had 4 years at the School of Architecture at Auckland University.
Okay. What made you get into architecture?
I'd always found it interesting and kept pestering them at school by saying I thought I wanted to be an architect. So they decided to give me some technical drawing and arranged for me to meet an architect in Whanganui. And I kept on with that idea and applied for bursaries with the then Ministry of Works and the New Zealand Railways. I was fortunate to be accepted for both, but I could only take one.
Wow. So was this structure common at the time, getting bursaries for...
Yes, it was. The Ministry of Works was a very important organisation because it served as a training ground for architects, engineers and surveyors and others, particularly in the building and construction areas. And the eventual dismantling of the Ministry of Works was, in fact, not a good thing for the country.
Okay. But so that was that the normal way for New Zealanders to get into architecture then?
Oh, no. Of the, that's, I think it's about 40, perhaps, in the first year at the School of Architecture, probably a good 10 or 12 would be holders of bursaries.
Okay. And what did the bursary involve? Was it just some funding, or you were bonded? Or?
At that time, fees were paid if you'd passed what was called high school certificate, which was, I'm not sure what the equivalent is, the final year, upper 60. If you obtained a good pass, that you had your fees paid. And after that, a bursary provided further money, which went towards... board and whatever costs. So it was reasonably common.
Now, you said before we started there was something about the church was a reason for you to get into architecture.
At secondary school I was keen on tennis, and I used to play tennis at the St James Tennis Club, and while I was at school they rebuilt or built a new church, and I would see this going up each day, and that intrigued me. And one day when I went home, my father had plans of the church because he was doing the carpet laying in it. So I saw the plans and I saw the actual building being built, so I could relate the two.
Okay.
And I found that fascinating, and that sparked my interest.
Okay. Yeah. And so you trained as an architect, you worked in various places here and overseas... As an architect?
Always as an architect. By the time of my final year, I decided that I didn't really want to stay with New Zealand Railway, so I actually paid my bursary off and joined a private firm in Wellington who were working on the James Cook Hotel, which at the time was a very prestigious project. And so I was fortunate enough to work for that firm. And at that time I also had the great opportunity to work on Queen Margaret College in Wellington, a library and classroom block, which was an opportunity not many architects got at that early stage of their career. So
why was that? You were sort of an assistant to the senior architect?
The sketch design had been started but not completed by a more senior architect than me, but I then was given the job to actually look after and produce the working drawings and did the site supervision.
What brought about the move to Palmerston North?
I left New Zealand in 1972, went to Rhodesia as it was then, thinking I'd be there for 6 weeks, but found the place so fascinating that I decided to stay. I had met my wife Beverly, not my wife at that point, before leaving. We were going to meet up in England, but I convinced her to come to Rhodesia.
Well, you were on holiday in Rhodesia?
No, I was, but had a very good friend there, which was the reason why I went there. And I'd always wanted to go to Africa. I used to being a good Sunday school attendee, I used to get books at the end of the year, which were often about a missionary called Dr. Paul and his work in Africa, and those stories fascinated me. So when my good friend was there, I decided I would go there to see him. Really liked the place, decided to stay, suggested to Bev that she come to see me, and I proposed to her when she got off the plane, and we were married 10 days later. We stayed there 2 years, and we couldn't stay any longer, otherwise I would have had to go into the Rhodesian army to fight in the Zambezi Valley.
Was that because of your age, was it, at the time? Or?
No, it's just any European person living in the country had to do their duty, if you want to put it that way, according to the white government.
Was this at the time of the Universal Declaration of Independence?
This was after. UDI was 1965. Mm-hmm. And to be frank, I was not really too conversant with all that. Yeah. And I was only going there for see my friend and for a short term, but decided I needed to see more of the place.
But it was still going on?
Oh, yes. My first Christmas there, there were the first attacks on outlying farmhouses in the north, which there had been skirmishes, but many years previously. This was really the beginning of what became the eventual
independence.
War, which, depending on which side of the you were on, had different names.
Yes. Now you said you'd read about Africa, so you wanted to go. Was it as you expected it?
It's hard to say, because obviously in a place like Rhodesia, it was of all the Central African states at the time, it was the most advanced in terms of how Western society would see it. So certainly the lifestyle was, for the white people, was certainly very good, but many times it was compared to South Africa, but it was poles apart from South Africa. In fact, the white Rhodesian was the closest I've ever come across to a New Zealander as I saw us at the time.
Was it fairly integrated then, or were the whites quite separate?
It was economically segregated. Technically, African people could go anywhere, but it was economic segregation that stopped them from doing it. There was some segregation regarding land, which I'd never really quite got to the bottom of, But again, I think it was essentially economic. The price of land was such that an ordinary African would have no chance of purchasing land in the better areas, which of course were the highest areas of the veld, because the climate is more livable, particularly for European people. Mm-hmm. And the lower land, of course, is hotter and more subject to illnesses and disease.
Now, architecture then, is it very similar? You can move around the world and just apply architecture, or is it quite different?
Architecture is a universal profession. It's a little bit like music. You know, the similarities are there across the board. Yeah. And certainly our training in New Zealand was regarded highly in England and in Africa. I think because, as I mentioned earlier, I was given opportunities early in my career to actually work on buildings in every aspect of them, whereas in England, when I worked there, there were other graduates of my age who had yet to have a building built. And for many of them, it would be many years before they would get a building built, because of the red tape, if you like, and the planning procedures in Britain were so complex and lengthy that it took such a long time for a project to get underway compared to New Zealand.
Okay. Yeah.
It's a matter of interest, Dennis. The measurements and things that you used in New Zealand would be the same worldwide, but did that apply to America too, where they still seem to stick rigidly to the old imperial measurements?
Well, I can't speak for America, but yes, they are using imperial measurements still, although they have their own version, don't they? Their gallon's different and all sorts of things.
Yeah.
I trained, of course, under feet and inches, although it was just changing. Most of my working life was metric.
Mm-hmm.
So metric was the universal
measurement
everywhere, so apart from America, I understand.
Yeah. Okay, now coming back to New Zealand then, you I think we're starting to say how you ended up in a job in Palmerston North.
Right. I was lucky enough in England. We had our first child born in England, and we came back when he was 3 months old. Friends back in Wellington knew that I was coming back, and I had an offer to join a firm in Wellington before I'd even left England, which was encouraging and flattering. And it's an interesting story, because the flat we handed on in England was to one of my flatmates from Wellington from many years before, who was coming from the firm that I joined, which was Structon Group Architects and Engineers. So I arrived back in New Zealand with a job, which is pretty wonderful to have. And I worked there for 3 years.
In those days, were jobs hard to get?
No, I don't think they were, but there was always competition for them. There was always people lining up for them, but not.
Yeah.
I went through a period here recently when I was looking for people to work in Palmerston North, and when I advertised, I'd get 20 applicants, all coming out of the schools of architecture. Most of them were classmates. So because they were all equal, I had to see them all. So they used to come up from Wellington in the same car, four of them, and then return to Wellington that day, having all been interviewed by me and all wondering why I asked each of them different questions.
Yeah.
When one of them eventually, I picked one of them, when he came, he asked me that. He said, "Why did you ask us different questions?" And I said, "Well, it's pretty boring talking to four of you in a day and asking you all the same question." So
yeah, there's also the danger that one comes out and says what they were asked. So now we did have, talking to someone from a legal background, there were issues there some time ago about other family connections or old established families and so on for getting into that. Was architecture similar to that?
I don't think so. There are many architects, of course, whose father, in some cases his mother, was an architect. So there's a bit of that, but usually they're joining their own family's firm, so that's not an issue.
No, so the employment structure is a bit different. It's more large architectural firms doing big projects rather than small individual or small practices.
First of all, most employers hopefully are looking for someone who's a good designer, one would hope. With a variation in the size of practices, there'll be some practices that are looking for someone to fill a particular role. And sometimes architects have different skills. Some are what I call design architects, who have the creative ability to design good buildings. There are those who have a technical ability, whose skill is actually making sure that working drawings and things are of a standard and everything fits and works. And then there are others who become administrators. In fact, like most professions, that's one of the worst aspects, is that the better people often end up becoming administrators, not using the skills that they have as whatever it is, whether it's an architect or a surgeon or a lawyer.
And the structure was mainly large companies?
No, New Zealand has, the tradition here is for small companies. We have, I forget the figures now, but the Institute of Architects would publish figures, and it varies now, but there would be only a handful of firms in the country would have more than 20 employees, and I might be wrong on these figures.
Or as architects, or a few architects and not as...
Well, if they had 20 employees, probably four or five, six maybe architects, then there'd be, going down the scale, different skills, draftsmen. The 20 is probably a wrong figure there. It's actually would now be much higher, but the majority of practices fall in the under 10.
Okay. And it's not the large international firms that you might say is for a
More so now, yes. A lot of Australian firms came into the country when some of our government organisations suffered what's often termed the cultural cringe, not thinking that we had the skills in this country to do the work ourselves, therefore we needed someone from somewhere else. Good example of that is Te Papa, although it was a New Zealand firm who did it eventually, but
and the finalists, perhaps.
Sorry?
And the Beehive, perhaps.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, one thing that we hear a lot, especially these days, is the issue of earthquakes and earthquake strengthening and so on. Was that a major factor of architectural design or the technical aspect in your training?
Yes, in as much as that when we designed buildings, we had to be aware of seismic movement. So we would design buildings to accommodate movement. And a good example of that would be going back to the James Cook Hotel. It was built on the airspace above a car parking building, and the building was rectangular, but the lift shaft was a separate structure to one side. And at the top of the lift shaft, we had to allow for a variation of movement of the two structures of 300 millimetres. In other words, at the peak of a pretty reasonable earthquake, the buildings would perhaps move in opposite directions at the same time, and that could mean a difference of 300 millimetres from when they would be at rest, as it were.
Was something that I wondered with Wellington and the earthquake risk, with all the tall buildings along the terrace, for example, if they all started swaying differently, they might all stand up if they're independent, but would they be bumping into each other? And there's enough safety margin in that?
That should be taken into account, because that could happen if they were built literally cheek by jowl with a minor separation. Then that could happen, that the buildings would actually hit.
Now here, after the major Christchurch earthquakes, there's been issues of raising standards and a lot of buildings being considered substandard. Have you found that the requirements have changed much over time?
In terms of architectural design, not so much, because, as I said, we were accommodating movement in the design. Mm-hmm. The requirement now is for much stronger or better design buildings engineering-wise, which can accommodate the movement of these earthquakes. It does come through into the detailing of buildings as far as I can see.
So is it more a distinction? It's an engineering problem rather than an architectural problem?
It is an engineering problem primarily, but it's an architectural problem in as much as that much of the work that's being done now is actually dealing with the existing buildings. And so you've got to find ways of making those buildings comply, which always comes through at some point into the architectural side of it. For instance, currently I'm working on St Andrew's Church in the city, and the engineers have decided that they need buttresses to hold up the nave walls. So my job is actually ensuring that the design of the buttresses, that the architectural appearance of those buttresses is in keeping with the original building. And the subsequent issues of in building the buttresses, we then have some architectural issues of it interrupts the current building's water flow off the roof and disposal of rainwater. So I have to work that out in a way that fits in with the heritage of the building, because this building is listed by the City Council, and so it has to comply. They refer it to Heritage New Zealand. So I am working with the architect for Heritage New Zealand, who also happens to be a personal friend who went through the School of Architecture with me. and not that there's any advantage in that other than knowing each other well. We still have to do the right job.
And Dennis, I wanted to ask you about these buildings in smaller towns, like the Martin's been in the paper recently, and Fielding. Those buildings have been there for a long time and lived through quite a few earthquakes. It seems a bit almost unfair, doesn't it, now that the owners have to go to all this trouble to try and bring them up to some sort of standard. Do you think that's reasonably fair, or that there's any solution to this?
I suppose fairness is a hard thing to decide. I think it's very tough on the building owners when they are told they have to do something, because making some of these buildings comply with the new building code would mean that it becomes uneconomic. And then, of course, the other side of that is if nothing is done, they pull down, and so the whole fabric of our smaller towns would change dramatically, and it wouldn't be the places that we knew anymore.
Yeah.
I think there needs to be some middle ground reached, and I think there has to be some acceptance of what is reasonable risk. And I think the best way I can think of that is we should have a sign at all our airports saying you're entering dangerous country, earthquake prone, enter at your own risk. It's a fact of life, isn't it?
Yes, and the last one out, please turn the lights out.
but Roger's point, these buildings have withstood earthquakes through a long period of time since they were originally built, obviously, and they're still standing. So are we over-emphasising potential risk? Is it getting worse?
Well, I think so, but I suppose the other point is, as you said, they've been through a lot of earthquakes. It would be so one
weakened.
Point of view would say, yes, they're slowly being weakened. With the smaller provincial towns, they're mostly two-storey buildings we're talking about here, and they're mostly masonry construction. Probably the weakest feature of all those buildings would be the parapets, the traditional parapets on the street frontage, and some of the verandas. But I actually think there are ways of attending to that, and I think it needs the local government and the government to actually provide more financial assistance to those building owners to help them meet the standards. But I do think it's overzealous. Single-storey timber frame buildings do not fall down in an earthquake. If people think they've seen one, usually it'll be because the masonry chimney has fallen over, or they may have fallen off their foundations. But I recall the Green Island incident down in Dunedin, where buildings on a landslide slipped down the valley.
Yes, I remember that, yes.
The whole houses...
When was this?
Oh, 80s?
Yes, it's a while ago now, yeah.
Whole buildings slid down the hillside, but not a window cracked, because they were actually boxes and quite stable. Yeah. They'd come off their foundation, they just slid down. You literally could have craned them back up and put them on. Yeah. But that sparked a whole new thing about earthquakes. Yeah.
It was interesting for me coming from the UK about 40 years ago, because there the idea of wooden buildings would be considered, these are temporary construction, not very strong compared to the common brick and stone, and yet in fact they're a far better construction for New Zealand.
Well, some of the oldest buildings in England and in the UK are wooden, aren't they?
There's the timber frame.
The old
timber frame.
I think the oldest building in the world is wood. Is that...
Surviving. No, well, there's a place, Scarra Brae, and a place like that in Scotland, which are stone, but there's not much wood that would have survived. Yeah.
I mean, buildings are built out of what's available locally. And in New Zealand, it was wood. I mean, the only stone quarries we have are either Oamaru, Timaru, or up in near Huntly. Yeah. And also
Memorial Park area, where they got a lot of money. That's more gravel than
stone. That was gravel and clay for making bricks.
Yeah.
So clay was available throughout the country. But here, bricks, apart from the early days when buildings were built out of... double skin brick or solid brick masonry. Bricks only uses the cladding here now, essentially. Yeah. And up to
the first story, isn't it?
It depends, because engineering design, you can go higher than that.
Yeah.
But in fact, you'll see many earthquake areas where there's been an earthquake, you'll actually find that it's the timber frame standing and the brick's fallen over, because the brick is literally tied to the timber, so the timber is the structural element, not the brick.
Thank you for listening to Manawatu Conversations. This and other recent programs can also be found on the Manawatu People's Radio website, and a range of programs is also available on the Manawatu Heritage website of the Palmerston North City Archive. The address for that is manawatuheritage.pncc.govt.nz.
Support this program and others like it by giving a donation to NPR. More details at npr.nz.